It is Monday, February 3rd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I mean, it's Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with authors Rilla Askew and Timothy O'Grady. Plus, we continue our monthly series on numbers by examining the number 2. Also, we have the latest installment of Arkansongs, Roby Brock has his weekly business news recap, and more. But first, yesterday, Fayetteville and much of the rest of Northwest Arkansas received about 5 inches of snowfall, leaving area highways covered in snow. But Danny Strasley with the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department says the only challenge yesterday for highway crews was the number of people already out on the roads when the rain turned to snow.
As the snow quickly began to accumulate, that started a number of traffic backups as accidents started to occur and such. And when you have traffic backed up on the highway, our crews can't get in there and treat the road. So that eventually worked itself out, and we worked through the day and through the night to work on the roads, and looks like, according to the forecast, I guess there's an event coming through tonight. And so our crews are finishing up yesterday's storm, and then we'll have a night crew come in this evening to start preparing for what may arrive overnight, and we'll do it all over again.
Strasley says much of the state saw mostly snow, though some areas in northeast Arkansas received some ice. He says the highway department adjusts its plan for clearing roadways as much as possible before the wintry precipitation moves in, and that everything relies upon timing.
There are certain cases where we like to get out and pre-treat the roads with various methods, but you know, if we pre-treat it too early and there's some rain that precedes the winter weather event, why, that's just going to wash it right off the road. Other times, we can time it just right so that we can get straight salt out on the road, and any rain that's in the process of changing over to snow will activate that salt. And of course, as salt gets wet, it releases heat. And so that helps form a barrier on the road between the top of the road and the ice, and makes it easier to remove. We can't prevent precipitation from forming on highways in Arkansas, but we can do things to help facilitate its removal.
To help facilitate the removal of snow and ice from highways, Strasley says the highway department has started to invest in new equipment, such as belly plows and another piece of equipment called a tow plow, which can clear 2 lanes of highway at once. That made its debut yesterday, clearing portions of Interstate 540 near Fort Smith. We'll have more on what weather to expect in the coming days in just a few minutes. The city of Fayetteville has been rated favorably in terms of fire coverage for its residents. The Insurance Services Office is a national organization that evaluates communities' public fire protection by assessing areas such as water supply, emergency communications, and the city's fire departments. The organization recently evaluated Fayetteville and reclassified the city from a Class 4 rating to a Class 2 rating. Like golf courses, the lower the number, the better. But what do the numbers mean? Fayetteville Fire Chief David Dayringer explains.
Well, it means that their insurance companies are going to have this new data and this new public protection classification, and it could lead to lowered insurance premiums. You know, it's not automatic, but it's something that the insurance companies and the underwriters will take into consideration when they're determining premium rates for commercial, industrial, and personal property premiums.
Chief Dayringer says the city made several investments over the years, which resulted in the better ISO rating.
Keep in mind, the last time Fayetteville was rated was back in the late 90s. And so between then and now, Fayetteville has built fire stations. We have replaced old sections of our water lines throughout the city, replaced and added fire hydrants. We have added a water tower. And so we've really improved the infrastructure and the water supply that the firefighters need to suppress a fire in a building. And we've expanded the fire department so that our response times are greatly improved from what they were 15 years ago.
But to improve to a Class 1 ISO rating, Chief Dayringer says the city would need to continue to make improvements, including the addition of more firefighters and the addition of another fire company. The new ISO rating takes effect on June 1st. After changes made last year to the state's parole system, county jails have seen an influx of inmates. Sheriffs are reporting overcrowding, and Governor Mike Beebe has proposed additional funds. In his weekly radio address, Beebe warns failing to reauthorize funding in next month's fiscal session for the private option Medicaid expansion would result in a loss of nearly $89 million in savings and make it harder to find funds for prisons. Beebe also made a link between health care and criminal activity.
Community health centers would likely have to cut critical services. And when fewer people can find the mental health services they need, they often find themselves in trouble. Which brings it all back to our county jails and our sheriffs, who would face the specter of still more people entering our backed up correction system.
Beebe is calling for an additional $7 million to buy more beds for inmates and to compensate counties for taking care of inmates originally intended to be sent to state prison. Later this month, John Q. Hammon Center in Rogers will play host to a concert with two superstars of the music world. Walmart announced this morning that on February 22nd, it will host a free concert at the center with Patti LaBelle and Gladys Knight. Part of the Northwest Arkansas performances will also be simulcast live as part of the 45th NAACP Image Awards being held in Pasadena, California. The event will be free and open to the public, but RSVP is required. Cloudy tonight with lows in the mid-20s. Tomorrow, expect some occasional sleet before noon with a chance of snow in the early afternoon, moving to drizzle or freezing drizzle after 3 p.m. Little or no ice accumulation and snow and sleet accumulation of less than an inch in northwest Arkansas, and they expect less than a tenth of an inch of ice accumulation in the Arkansas River Valley. Highs will be around 33 degrees. Tomorrow night, expect cloudy conditions with a chance of snow and freezing drizzle before midnight, and a low of 18 with a wind chill as low as 7 in northwest Arkansas. In the Arkansas River Valley, expect cloudy conditions with a low around 25. This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, Mercy Fort Smith celebrated the opening of its new Mercy Breast Center. The center is a 6,900 square foot space located on the first floor of the Mercy Medical Building. Michelle Bonds, the center's manager, says there was an initiative throughout Mercy to improve the health of women in general, and when developing the new breast center, they investigated what needs had to be met to help increase breast cancer awareness.
We want to try to reach as many people as we can. Right now, Arkansas falls below the national average for screenings, and so we're trying to make an impact on that. Right now, we're between 60% and 65% that get screened, and the national average is 70%.
According to a report from the American Cancer Society, the percentage of women 40 years of age and older who report having had a mammogram within the past 2 years has stabilized around 67%. According to the National Cancer Institute, women have about a 1 in 8 chance of being diagnosed with breast cancer at some point during their life. The new center, which cost $1.5 million, will help ensure residents have access to the appropriate healthcare services. Bonds explains Mercy Health Foundation donated $1 million to the project, and the hospital was responsible for raising the remaining $500,000. The new facility will allow patients to receive treatments they had to travel out of the region for in the past.
Here at Mercy, we did not have the capability to do light breast MRIs, and so that was one of the new modalities that we added. So that also included if there was an abnormality on the MRI, they would also have to travel outside to Northwest Arkansas or Little Rock to have a biopsy performed under MRI.
The new center will offer digital mammography for initial screenings. To help in early detection, the center also has two additional new screenings, an automated whole breast ultrasound and breast MRI technology.
The whole breast ultrasound is, of course, it is done with sound waves. It is a breast ultrasound, but it scans the entire breast in one swoop, and then it reconstructs that image into a 3D image. And the purpose of this is in conjunction with a normal mammogram for women who have dense breast tissue. It can be harder to see through that dense breast tissue on a mammogram, and so this is just another modality that we can use to be able to penetrate and look into that dense breast tissue. And the MRI is, again, is good for the dense breast tissue. They use the MRI also if we've already confirmed that the patient has a cancer in one breast. They will a lot of times do an MRI to see if there are any additional areas that need to be looked at.
According to Mercy's website, the center offers automated whole breast ultrasound. It's the first in the region and the only breast cancer screening technology specifically developed and FDA approved for women with dense breast tissue. If a mass is detected, the breast center offers stereotactic guided biopsy and ultrasound guided biopsy. According to the hospital's website, MRI-guided biopsy will soon allow physicians to determine if a tumor is malignant or benign in a minimally invasive way. When it comes to knowing when and how often women should be screened, Bond says they follow guidelines set by the American Cancer Society. These guidelines recommend that women 40 and older have annual mammograms unless there's a strong history of cancer in their family. Bond says, for example, women whose mother or perhaps grandmother were diagnosed in their early 20s or 30s, they will likely begin their screenings earlier. So once women make an appointment for a screening at the center, what can they expect during their visit?
When you come in, we're asking questions like family history, any surgeries. We try to get a good history on you. And when you come in, you just simply undress in our dressing room. We're very discreet here. We keep it very private in our area. You come in, there's one female tech that does the mammogram. And basically, we have four views that we take. The compression does need to be snug, but it doesn't need to hurt you. So we try to make it as comfortable for the woman and being able to still get good images on her.
Michelle Bonds, the breast center's manager, says they average 10 to 11,000 mammograms each year. Of those, they typically find 70 to 80 breast cancers they biopsy in their facility. Although they have the new center, they will continue operating their mobile mammography unit, which, according to Mercy's website, serves about 1,600 women in 13 counties annually. Bond says the unit travels to hospitals, clinics, doctor's offices, and sometimes even to factories where medical personnel conduct digital mammograms so women don't have to leave work. This mobile unit, as well as the new breast center, are all ways to promote the importance of screenings, which can result in early detection of breast cancer.
It's not that we want to find more cancers. We just want to find them sooner so that your treatment is less. It's, you know, you're looking at lumpectomy versus mastectomy, maybe a reduction in the chemo or any kind of treatment that you might have to have. So the sooner you can find it, the better your survival chances are.
According to the hospital's website, the Mercy Breast Center is a provider for the Arkansas Breast Care Program, and the Mercy Foundation sponsors the To Save a Life program. Both programs are available to help women who are uninsured or underinsured pay for mammograms and other diagnostic services. The Mercy Breast Center is open from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. More information is available at mercy.net/FortSmithAR. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Last week, the state witnessed another big bank deal. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details in his weekly business and political news recap.
Little Rock-based Bank of the Ozarks announced Thursday it has entered into a definitive agreement to buy Summit Bank Corp. and its wholly owned bank subsidiary, Summit Bank. Bank of the Ozarks will acquire the Arkadelphia-based bank for $216 million. Summit Bank operates 23 banking offices and one loan production office in 9 Arkansas counties in central and southwest Arkansas. As of December 31st, 2013, Summit Bank had approximately $1.2 billion of total assets. The move will push Bank of the Ozarks to more than $6 billion in total assets. Tyson Foods pulled in a first quarter profit of $254 million, up nearly 47% from the previous year, as all segments of the Springdale-based meat giant performed better. Total revenue for Tyson Foods in the quarter was $8.76 billion. That was up from 1 year ago. Arkansas Best appears to have turned the corner. The Fort Smith-based less-than-truckload trucking firm posted fourth quarter net income of $10.3 million. That was a big swing from last year's fourth quarter loss of $7.9 million. Revenue also rose to more than $578 million during the quarter. Murphy Oil saw a diminished fourth quarter due to its spinoff of its refinery and retail operations and other one-time charges, but its full-year earnings topped $1 billion in 2013. For the full fiscal year, Murphy Oil's net income cleared $1.12 billion. That was up from about $971 million 1 year ago. In August of last year, Murphy Oil spun off its refinery and retail operations into a new public company, Murphy USA. Axiom Corporation saw its third quarter net income rise to $15 million. That was up just a little bit from $14.5 million 1 year ago. Revenues also climbed higher to $277 million during the quarter. That was an improvement from the previous year. The Little Rock-based Data Marketer, which has been downsizing its workforce, realigning its internal operations, and expanding its client offerings, saw higher revenue in two of its three key segments. Republican Representative Tom Cotton was the only member of Arkansas's congressional delegation to vote against the Farm Bill, a compromise measure that emerged after House and Senate negotiators ironed out differences in previously passed bills. The National Farm Bill funds direct payment programs for farmers, crop insurance programs, and food assistance for families. Republican Senator John Bozeman and Republican Representative Rick Crawford both served on the conference committee that developed the final measure. Democratic Senator Mark Pryor, who's being challenged by Representative Cotton, voted for the bill. And finally, Arkansas's jobless rate fell slightly in December. The December unemployment rate fell to 7.4%, down 1/10 of a point from November. 1 year ago, Arkansas's jobless rate stood at 7.1%, however, in December. The U.S. unemployment rate for the month of December fell 3/10 of a percent to 6.7%. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. It is Monday, February 3rd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Are you bored yet?
Bored of what?
Winter. I am so bored with winter.
I mean, if it's interesting, if I can get some snow that I can play in instead of just being cold, then I'm interested.
And if it's just icky?
Less interested.
If it's less interesting, then let's go to the Art Center of the Ozarks, Trike Theater, or Arts Live Theater for some classes.
Can I go to all of them instead of just or?
Sure.
Okay.
You can.
Okay.
Starting tomorrow at Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, Toosie Doodlers for obviously little kids.
Oh, I can't go to that one.
Ages 20 to 36 months.
Okay.
Mini Doodlers also starts tomorrow for ages 3 to kindergarten. We're getting better.
Okay.
After School Art Exploration, which also starts tomorrow for, let's see, what grades? Ages 6 to 16.
Okay.
At Trike Theater, their Winter Station 2 starts February 11th with classes for ages 4 to grade 12. And at Arts Life Theater, starting this week, Land of Make-Believe for grades K and 1st. Monologues and Audition Technique, February 3rd, that's today, for grades 8 to 12. Theater Art, grades 2 to 4. Schoolhouse Rock, ooh, that'd be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Grades 5 to 7. Telling Tales, Little Mermaid, The Songs of the Jungle Book, and Comedy Improv, all starting now at those three arts organizations.
So lots of things for the kiddos to do.
I bet they'd let us sneak in.
Probably. Maybe we could, like, audit the class, like in college.
There's a plan.
I like it. Thank you,
we'll
Becca.
Talk.
Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. One is often called the loneliest number. To get to the number two, you must first have two ones. One plus one is two. As we begin the second month of the year, we visit with University of Arkansas math professor Edmund Harris about the even number two.
Two.
Four.
Six.
Eight.
Ten.
12.
14.
16.
18.
20.
22.
Today we're going to talk about the number two.
Right.
And it's a number that really you start getting into numbers with two. With one, it's sort of itself, but with two, that's where you're starting to express something with numbers.
Okay.
Because everything comes in ones, if you look at it correctly. Everything is unique. The expression, you can't cross the same river twice. It's when we start to talk about two of something, we've identified two different things being the same in some sense.
How so?
Well, think of going to the supermarket and you look at all the groceries out there and you look at a big bucket of apples. And they're all very different things. They might come from different trees. They have slightly different tastes, even if they're the same variety.
There are no two apples that are alike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With one, everything's individual. But as soon as you get to two, you have to say these things are really the same, at least for some purpose. You also need two in order to combine things.
One plus one is two.
Yeah. And in order to have one plus one, you needed two numbers. And so with two, we really start to go beyond just language and start to get into a little bit of mathematics. And two is also a very human number.
Human number?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Does it have feelings?
Well, it's a number that turns up in humans a lot.
Okay. Well, I mean, we tend to have two hands.
Yeah.
Two eyes. Yeah.
Two ears, two nostrils. We have a symmetry to our bodies that means that we have a left and right side. And the left and right side we can identify as being the same for some purposes.
Also, humans tend to pair off and make couples.
Yeah.
Right? So two things make a pair.
Yeah. And that is, again, where two is different from one. In order to have sexual rather than asexual reproduction, you need to have two things coming together to combine. And two is the smallest collection, so it's, I don't think, a surprise that nearly all species that have sexual reproduction have two individuals to do that with. And human beings are amongst the species that then turn that into, instead of just two for a coupling, two for raising children as well often. So.
Is there that saying that three's a crowd?
Anyway. Yeah. Well, the third person is the gooseberry. But the thing, another aspect of two that I want to talk about in more detail is an aspect that allows us to be a lot more efficient with how we write numbers. And so last month we talked a little bit about writing numbers by tallying. And so you can, if you want to write one, you write one mark. If you want to write two, you write two marks, and so on. And tallying is very good, but I have to use as many symbols as I want to count. But if we allow ourselves, instead of having just one symbol that we'll repeat, having two different symbols that we repeat, we can be far, far more efficient in writing numbers. And two is the smallest number of symbols that we can actually do this with. And the system is called binary numbers.
And bi typically means two.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And this is because it has the two symbols. Mm-hmm. So the way to think about it, we can start, if we want to write one, we just have to write one. And then to write two, we can write one followed by a zero. And that means that we have a two and no ones.
Okay.
So at the moment, we're just as the same as the tallying. We had one mark for one, two marks for two. But now for three, we can write 1, 1, which means 1, 2 and 1, 1. 2 plus 1 is 3.
Okay. Yeah.
So we can now write three with just two symbols. Four, we can write as 1 for 1, 4. 0 for no 2s and 0 for no 1s.
Okay.
So 4 can be written 1, 0, 0.
Okay.
Well, then 5 is going to be 1, 0, 1, 4 plus 1. 6 is going to be 1, 1, 0, 4 and 2. So our symbols really, each one says, do we have the next power of 2? So you've got the powers of 2 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and so on. Mm-hmm. And you say, do we need each of those? And using this, we can actually build all the numbers. Let's do it the other way. Let's start with 100. It's more than 64, which is a power of 2, but it's less than 128.
Yes.
And so we need to take off 64.
Okay.
So you have 100, you take off 64, you have 36 left.
Yes.
36 is more than 32.
It is.
But it's less than 64.
Agreed.
So we take 32 off.
Mm-hmm.
This leaves 4.
4.
4 is less than 16, so mm-hmm. we don't need any 16s. It's less than 8.
Yes.
We don't need any 8s. It is exactly 4,
mm-hmm.
so we need a 4. Once we take 4 away from 4, we don't have anything left.
No, 0.
So we don't need any 2s or 1s. So we can write 100 as 110010.
Say that again.
110010.
Okay.
We're very much into the stereotype of mathematicians talking now. And all that expression means is that we'll start from the other end. We'll mm-hmm. start from the final zero. That means there's no ones. The zero before that means no twos. The one means 1, 4. And we've got 2 zeros, no eights and no 16s. 132 and then 164. And together we get the number 100.
Okay.
And this takes only 7 symbols. With the system of tallying, we would need to write 100 symbols to get to a number like 100.
Mm-hmm.
So the tallying is a very good system for small numbers, but by the time you get your large numbers are already something like 100.
Right, and it would take you a long time to make 100 hash marks.
Yeah. And you might make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with this binary system, we can get away with just mm-hmm. 7. So I think now we want to ask people to what they think of numbers.
Of numbers, okay. All the numbers or a specific number?
Well, for next month, we'd like to hear what you think of number 3.
Okay. What sorts of things would we like to hear from our listeners?
Well, your favorite number or what feelings you have towards a number. I think some people associate numbers with colors. We're looking to see how people perceive numbers and how they work with them in their own lives and think about them.
You can send those to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com, or what about directly to you?
That's E. Harris, that's EHARRISS at uark.edu.
Edmund Harris is a math professor at the University of Arkansas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Rilla Askew and Timothy O'Grady are both visiting associate professors with the University of Arkansas's programs in creative writing and translation. Rilla's latest novel, Kind of Kin, has just been released in paperback and earned a glowing review from the New York Times Book Review. Timothy's work is both in fiction and nonfiction, and his books include Motherland, which Publishers Weekly declared possesses a rare eloquence that gives the book a grandeur seldom encountered in contemporary fiction. Thursday night, both will read from their works at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to both writers about their work, teaching at the U of A this year, and if they've had the chance to read each other's work.
That's a very interesting question. Not really. And I think it's because there's an assumption that we make as fellow writers, as fellow fiction writers, and we're both novelists and we both work in other forms. Timothy writes creative nonfiction, writes nonfiction actually quite a bit. And so do I. And so I think we don't talk so much specifically about our individual work as we talk about the condition of being a writer and what that demands and how one lives as a writer. Especially a writer of literary fiction and how challenging that is to make a living at it and to establish yourself in the world.
I think it's also been unfortunate that, I mean, just the demands of teaching are such that I don't have a chance to read anything that I don't have to read in order to teach. And I haven't read Rilla's books, and I'm looking forward to reading Rilla's books. and I will read Rilla's books in the summer, but I haven't had a chance to do that, and I lament that.
Well, it's interesting, and this question is now moot, because as an outsider on the surface, I thought there was some commonality, because Kind of Kin deals with people in a way coming to this land and immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And you're someone who emigrated from the U.S., and I think that's somewhat in your writing. So there is that movement that exists, but obviously—
I think that's sort of serendipitous that we happened to both come here at the same time. And I also think that the relationship between writers, I've seen this, I see it with Tim, and I've seen it in other circumstances, that whether we know one another's work or not, we know one another as a writer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I believe that is true, yeah.
I imagine one of the more difficult parts of writing, whether it's nonfiction, whether it's literary fiction, is the ability to expand on an idea. I would think ideas are great, that you can find them a lot, but then knowing that there's enough there to devote the next part of your life to writing about it would be difficult.
That's the essential question, the one you're asking, I think. And it's if an idea comes to you, particularly if you're writing novels. A friend of mine has been writing novels for a long time, and he stopped, and he's writing short stories now, and he finds the relief of just having something be expendable. Like, if it doesn't work out, well, so what? You know, he's only spent 2 days on it or something. I mean, if you commit yourself to a novel, you might be committing yourself to 5 or 6 years on a single idea. And if the idea runs out of steam, as I've seen happen with novels, novels sometimes start with a rush of energy and then slowly dissipate themselves through the pages because the idea isn't substantial enough to carry them through all the way. And you do have to be able to recognize an idea that contains enough that is the story that you want to tell, that you would love to be with, that you could engage with over such a long period of time through all the uncertainty and confusions and anxieties involved in producing a novel and getting lost. But the idea has to make you hungry enough to do it and have the patience to do it and the tolerate your own doubts during this process. And I think that is the secret. I mean, the idea creates the desire to express the idea, and the desire to express the idea allows you to put up with everything you have to put up with in order to write a novel. And, of course, everybody wants to feel those ideas because their identity is in this activity. And it can be the case that you see with writers, particularly as they get older, sometimes they don't have ideas, but they still have the skill. They still want to keep their hand moving. I would think, I mean, I heard a story about Beckett where, you know, he would go to a table every day and he would put his hands on the table and he could sit for 3 hours and his hands wouldn't move. And there would be an exercise book which he would write in, and maybe another day his hand might move across and open it and nothing would happen. And another day he might open it and write a sentence and his whole soul is screaming, "That's a lie." I mean, can you imagine what that's like?
No. No, thank goodness I can.
I completely concur with everything Tim just said. And there's also the element of character. And so I think what you have to have is idea to carry you through 5 or 6 years, something that's substantial. But you also have – those characters have to have a vitality of their own that will also carry that forward, and that the life that they bring to it can sustain you, I think, sometimes through those – droughty periods or the times when you begin to understand that the thing that you started out with is not, you know, the notion that you started out with is not really what the book is going to be.
Well, let me ask you then, because in Kind of Kin, Sweet, the protagonist, did you start in the creative process with her?
Not at all. She took over that book. I began the book in the voice of a little boy, her nephew, who's a grandfather. Sweet's father has been incarcerated for harboring undocumented workers in his barn. And I thought that the entire book was going to be in that little boy's voice. He's 10 years old, and he's starting out saying, you know, telling the story about his grandfather's arrest, his grandfather being in jail, and the conditions of his life. He's raised by his grandfather. And I thought the book was going to be a modern-day Huckleberry Finn sort of telling of these conditions and seen through the eye, this complicated issue of undocumented immigration seen through the innocent eyes of a young boy who only sees the human beings involved. And then his aunt just took over the next chapter and she pretty much dominated the book. And I think a lot of fiction writers will tell you that it's not like you're channeling them. It's not as if it's as if that's where you can write. Sometimes you want to write something else, but the place where you are able to write, and in this case, it was Sweet's voice.
You're sharing a reading at Nightbird Books. Have you discussed how that will be organized?
No, we have not. But it's on Thursday, and I think on Thursday, the 4th of February, and I think that we'll discuss it.
6th, I think, isn't it?
6th.
I think it's the 6th.
It's the first Thursday in February.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, Thursday, February 6th.
Right.
We've got time to talk about it. We did one reading at the university for the fellow MFA students there already, and it was quite varied. Our approaches were very different. The material that we read was very different, and it made for an interesting reading. I thought, at least that seemed to be the response from the faculty and students. So we're not in the same bailiwick, and that makes it more interesting.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to it because that first reading we did was really just for the MFA program, so it was the professors and the students. I mean, I've since had undergraduate students. I've got neighbors, you know, I've met people in the street, and it would be, you know, a pleasure for me to see them there, and I imagine Rilla has the same experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm looking forward just to, you know, talking to people that I have met in the course of being here through this reading.
What, if anything, did you know about the MFA program at the University of Arkansas before you arrived here?
I've been hearing about this MFA program since 1993 when I had a student who had longed to be here and didn't get accepted here. And so I've known for many years how well-regarded the program is, and I've had another former student who came and graduated from this program has gone on to publish her first novel. And then eventually I met Molly Giles, who was here for some time, and she is a wonderful writer and became, a good acquaintance. And so I've been on the – and I'm divide my time between New York and Oklahoma, so being as close in proximity, Oklahoma to Fayetteville, I've heard about it from that venue as well. So it's been around in my consciousness for decades.
I live in Europe, so I don't really know so much about the MFA programs in the United States, but I was teaching in Las Vegas, and when I was there, people did speak about it. I knew Barry Hanna, who mm-hmm. I met once or twice.
Bats Out of Hell?
Yeah, and he was one of the first people that came through it. I heard the stories of the legendary Frank Stafford, and, you know, I heard some things about it, and I heard some innovative aspects about the program, and, you know, I just happened to see that the job was available, and I applied for it, and I'd been in Arkansas a few times. I remember a friend of mine, he was a poet friend of mine when I was a student, and I'd written to him when I first went through Arkansas in the 70s, and I said how much I loved it, and he said, well, your soul must not be dead yet if you love Arkansas. And, there was something very interesting and sweet and kind of noble about the place, and I thought it would be a very nice place to be for a while. So.
And Fayetteville has such a good reputation. Across the border, people speak of what I always hear, Fayetteville is a nice town. Fayetteville is a cool town. And it has – I've never heard one individual ever say one bad word about the small city of Fayetteville, which is kind of amazing, really.
Rilla, will you be reading from Kind of Kin?
I certainly will. Yes, it's just out in paperback, and so I'm looking forward to the opportunity to share a little of it with the public.
Well, and I think the region you're in, Fayetteville, Arkansas, it and of course it's – you know, set very close to here. You grew up close to here. I think people will take to it very much.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, it's something that's so much in the news at the time. It's something that our nation has to grapple with. It's about a state anti-illegal immigration law, which we have. Oklahoma passed theirs in 2007. It went into effect in November of that year, well before Arizona's law that got so much national attention. And there have been many states that have passed similar laws, and now they're backpedaling on it, and now there is a great conversation about immigration reform. But nothing has been done yet, and families continue to be separated every day. More people have been deported in during the Obama administration than in all the administrations before. So it's something that I think is urgent for our nation to deal with and to grapple with. And I'm just showing in the novel, as one does, how those larger forces affect one family and one community, small town community in southeastern Oklahoma. When these kinds of laws are passed, they have a really powerful ripple effect, and they affect people's lives when the lawmakers pass the laws, they may or may not understand.
Have anticipated.
Yeah.
What will you read from?
I'm not sure, but I probably will read from this novel I'm writing now. That's what I'm most interested in. I think I'm writing a novel which is primarily set in San Francisco. It starts in Ireland. The main character was an IRA activist sniper who's becoming a painter, or he's going back to painting. And I'm collaborating with a painter on this book, and that's what I'm mostly engaged in. So probably I'll read from that. But I'll talk to Rilla about what she's going to read, and we'll try to make it work that the two things are of similar sizes. And
they'll speak to each other.
Yes.
One last question. How difficult is it to come up with a title for your work?
You're watching me shake my head in great pain. It is always difficult.
Because what you have to do is part marketing. You have to do it in a very few words, and it has to summarize what you've put blood, sweat, and tears into.
Exactly. It's the last thing. It is always the last thing for me. I write an entire novel and then wrestle with the agent and the editor and try to say, what are we going to call this thing?
I think there's a lot of luck in titles. You know, they just land on you or they don't. And if they don't, then you have to do what Hemingway did, start reading the Bible and making notes and, you know, writing down phrases and, you know, combing all of literature for something that would work. And he used to do that, and he assembled large numbers of titles. But I think they kind of just – they can just drop into your head. I mean, I've had them drop into my head on airplanes and, you know – and they seem to work, but it feels lucky if you get them, I think. It's true that publishers can have ideas. I wrote a novel about Irish immigrants going to live in England, and it was at one point called Acts of Memory, which I was calling it that, but it just seemed like a, you know, dull, functional title. And the marketing department decided they wanted to call it Ireland. And I said, no, you can't. And they said, well, they then eventually told me that the sales reps were going to boycott the book unless I called it Ireland.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, well, fine. You know, they only have to live with it for a month. I have to live with it for the rest of my life. It's not going to be called Ireland. If you don't want to publish it, don't publish it. Wanted being called I Could Read the Sky.
Which is a great title.
Yeah. That came into my head on a plane.
Aha!
The objection to Ireland being that it was just so...
Well, it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
I mean, they have this idea that if you put, you know, a book called... Because, you know, U2 was popular and there were some other musicians and Irish culture was popular in Europe at the time.
It was
You know, and I said, well, like, all you have to do is go into a bookshop and see remainder bins full of little, you know, men with flat caps and donkey carts and a book called Ireland, and it's, you know, out of print before it's even hit the shelves practically. You know, it was just obnoxious. But I think sometimes, particularly the corporate publishers, can think that they have a handle on the marketing of something that I think is somewhat of an illusion.
Timothy O'Grady and Rilla Askew are both visiting associate professors this year in the University of Arkansas's programs in creative writing and translation. Rilla's latest novel, Kind of Kin, has just been released in paperback, and Timothy's works include Motherland. They'll both read from and discuss their work at 7 Thursday night at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Bobby Whitlock was born March 18, 1948, in Memphis, Tennessee. The family first moved to Arkansas when he was young, when his lay preacher father, Jimmy, took over a church in the middle of a cotton field in Marmaduke in Greene County. They later moved more semi-permanently to Dyess, northwest of Newport in Jackson County, when Whitlock was 9. Bobby Whitlock recalled living next door to the railroad track in Dyess with a blacksmith shop next door. Bobby and his mother, LaVeda, worked in the cotton fields around Dyess, Newport, Lepanto, and beyond. Always into music, he played guitar, piano, and sang. The day after he graduated high school, Bobby Whitlock left what he described as an abusive relationship with his father for musical freedom when his mother dropped him off at the corner of Poplar and Stonewall in Midtown Memphis, Tennessee, with $50 and a ham sandwich. Soon, he joined the band The Counts, which played around Memphis from 1965 to 1968, including at the famed Plantation Inn in West Memphis, Arkansas, and several dates opening up for Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. Bobby Whitlock got to know the musical couple Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett, also signed to Stax, by playing on their album. But they were leaving the Stax deal to go to Los Angeles, California, and sign with Elektra Records, and convinced Whitlock to join them. He was photographed at the Cabaret Club just before leaving Memphis with Delaney and Bonnie, wearing an Arkansas State College sweatshirt. Delaney and Bonnie's band, called The Friends, at various times had Leon Russell, Dave Mason, Rita Coolidge, Jim Keltner, and others, in addition to Whitlock. But Whitlock was there at the beginning, sleeping on the couple's living room couch in California.
Life I was unsure of, and then the Lord took me a wife, 'cause I was so alone. But the scenery has slowly changed. Yes, I see.
In late 1969, Delaney and Bonnie and Friends opened a tour for Blind Faith. That's where Whitlock met Eric Clapton. From there, Bobby Whitlock garnered his own solo deal. In 1971, Bobby Whitlock signed to Atlantic Records and went about recording his debut album with his bandmates in London. When he turned the tapes in, Whitlock learned executives had expected him to record with their session men in the U.S. with Tom Dowd producing. Instead, Whitlock bought himself out of his Atlantic contract and signed to ABC Dunhill Records, home to such acts of the era as Three Dog Night,
The eponymous Bobby Whitlock album was released in March 1972.
If I could ease your pain, if I could lighten your load, if I could make it just a little bit better for you, if I could just help you find that sacred place in your mind where the light of understanding, Lord, outshines the sun.
Famed Rolling Stones producer Jimmy Miller produced Bobby Whitlock's follow-up called Raw Velvet, and released in November 1972. In the mid-1970s, Whitlock recorded for Capricorn Records while living with Dickie Betts and Chuck Leavell in Macon, Georgia, who also played on his albums. The cover for Whitlock's album Rock Your Socks Off was drawn by Capricorn Records label mate Martin Mull. Despite the star power, Bobby Whitlock's albums did not blaze the charts. In fact, it would be nearly 25 years before Bobby Whitlock would again release another album.
Tell the story soft and sweet as it was. Flowers with bare feet, I should adore.
Recalling his upbringing in West Tennessee and East Arkansas, in which he described experiencing abuse and poverty, Bobby Whitlock said, "I come from people who are steeped in the lowest state of human consciousness that you can possibly imagine. What a place. That's all it ever was to me, just a place, never a home." Here in its entirety is Bobby Whitlock of Diaz, Arkansas, with "The Scenery Has Slowly Changed" from his 1972 solo album, Bobby Whitlock. Bobby Whitlock of Diaz, Arkansas, with "The Scenery Has Slowly Changed" from his 1972 album, also called Bobby Whitlock. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1998.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Pea Ridge. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Monday.